From VOA, Press Conference USA, here is your host, Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. On this year-end edition of the program, we bring you highlights from 2017. Hello again, I'm Carol Castiel. The year began in the United States with a newly elected president waiting in the wings to assume the highest office in the land. The unlikely electoral victory of real estate mogul and former reality TV star Donald J. Trump surprised pollsters and pundits alike. A cloud of controversy that began before Donald Trump was sworn in as the 45th president continues to hang over his presidency. In early January, the U.S. government's national security agencies released a joint report that determined Vladimir Putin and the Russian government took steps to influence the 2016 presidential election in Donald Trump's favor. The controversy quickly affected the Trump administration when the newly named head of the National Security Council, Michael Flynn, was forced to leave his position in mid-February. The resignation came after admitting that he had misled Vice President Mike Pence about his contacts with a Russian envoy after the November election. Political scientist Barry Posen, the Henry A. Kissinger Chair in Foreign Policy and International Relations at the Library of Congress's John W. Kluge Center, spoke about the Flynn resignation when he was my guest in February.
I think it's symptomatic of who we elected and his approach to running the government. He intended to shake things up. He brought in people who, though they had certain kinds of experience, were not necessarily committed to the status quo. They had a difficult time fully staffing their organizations. They had legal problems with the immigration and refugee presidential decision. So they had a lot of trouble. And General Flynn was a kind of an eccentric person by the standards of the national security business and was not really much loved. And he is a person who believes in charging ahead. And it looks like he charged ahead at a time when he really wasn't permitted by law to do so. And there was a fear that the fact that he had done that, which was known to the intelligence community, was known to the Russians, could be used as a blackmail tool against him. And it took the Trump administration about a month to sort all this out and to admit that they had a serious problem. It took leaks and public pressure and media pressure. And they were finally forced, under the worst possible circumstances, to dispense with his services. And that, of course, that means that the staff that he personally brought in will also probably go. So just as you were beginning to get some takeoff in organizing a rather unconventional National Security Council staff and national security policy, the key engineer of all that is gone, and they're going to have to start over. And that's not a good thing when you're the most powerful country in the world.
Barry Posen also talked about what has been described by some as the president's impulsive need to send out frequent and at times controversial messages via the social media platform Twitter. Posen says he's concerned the messages could produce dire consequences.
Yes, this is our first compulsively tweeting president, and also I think the first president who's so headstrong about his need to use these devices. It may serve the president's domestic political purposes very well, which raises questions of priority. But one has an uncomfortable feeling here that the foreign policy is in some sense being targeted for his domestic constituency, and that's going to lead you astray. He obviously has not been a kind of a foreign policy buff. So the failure to staff certain things, the failure to get advice on technicalities, all these kinds of details of any policy, they're coming after he has an impulse that he tweets. And so far, it's appeared more comical than disastrous, but one could imagine that it could produce a very dire consequence.
David Frum, senior editor at The Atlantic magazine and former speechwriter for President George W. Bush, appeared on our program in March. Mr. Frum, a normally conservative Republican, admitted that he voted for Democrat Hillary Clinton in the 2016 presidential election. He expressed his concerns about President Trump.
I've been very active in Republican politics my whole life, and I had been active with some of the candidates for the Republican nomination, and I had, of course, voted in the Republican primaries when there still seemed chances of stopping somebody like Donald Trump. To my mind, he's not at all like a Republican figure. He is like these kinds of populist authoritarians that we see springing up in Europe. In many ways, he is the expression inside the United States of something we have seen with Marine Le Pen in France, Geert Wilders in the Netherlands. And I'm not sure whether it makes sense anymore even to call these people left or right, because they have this new politics that is an amalgam of both those things, and a politics often very aligned with Moscow in Russia, a historic American adversary. My article asks the question, if somebody like this actually got their hands on the presidency of the United States, what would happen? Unlike the parliamentary democracies of Western Europe, the United States doesn't really have a civil service. The new president appoints the top two and three layers of the bureaucracy. Yes, we have a very independent judiciary. That probably cannot be changed. But we have very strong party control within Congress, and it's getting stronger all the time. So I talk in the article about how someone like Donald Trump, who is in office, in my opinion, first and foremost to enrich himself, can and probably will try one by one to turn off the safeguards of the integrity of our democracy.
The U.S. Constitution outlines a system of checks and balances so that each of the three branches of federal government, executive, legislative, and judicial, has the ability to control the power of the others. But with one political party in control of the executive and legislative branches, which has been appointing many like-minded individuals to the judicial branch, Frum said he's worried that the check-and-balance system may not work as designed.
What we didn't contemplate is what happens if you not only have a rogue president, but he's abetted by a Congress that has become so partisan, it no longer thinks, as it used to do, hey, he's the president, we're Congress, yes, you're a Republican, I'm a Democrat, but what we really care about is the power of Congress, and especially of the Senate, and we must protect our institution against the president, even if he happens to be of the same party. While the Congress is full of Republicans who personally mistrust Donald Trump, from a practical matter, they act as if he has absolute control of that body. And we see that, for example, in their unwillingness to investigate the very suspicious connections between him and Russian intelligence, the unwillingness to insist that Donald Trump comply with all of the historic norms about presidential disclosure, and the complete aversion from his family and his son-in-law, who are making perhaps even more money out of the presidency than Trump himself.
Richard Hawes, the president of the Council on Foreign Relations and the author of the book A World in Disarray, American Foreign Policy and the Crisis of the Old Order, was our guest for an April program. His book examines today's complex international stage within the rich context of world history. Hawes theorizes that chaos at home in America will likely result in chaos throughout the world, which could easily disturb the balance of global power. I asked Mr. Hawes what he meant by a world in disarray.
Well, the world's in disarray. I think if any listener would simply take a step back for a moment, the Middle East is in turmoil. Disarray is an understatement. Look at the number of failed states, civil wars, regional wars, you name it. Europe has gone from the most stable, predictable part of the world to anything but. You've had the Russian invasion of Crimea. You've had Brexit. We now have the uncertainty of the French elections, the Greek economy, the refugee crisis, the rise of populists and nationalists. The entire future of the European Union is suddenly in doubt. Asia, you've got the rise of China. You've got the North Korean nuclear and missile threat. You've got challenges in Latin America, say in Venezuela, South Sudan, or the DRC in Africa. And then globally, you have all sorts of areas where there's global challenges, say like cyber, the internet, and there's very few rules. So I think the disarray is obvious. How did we get here? In part, it's because of globalization and all these phenomena which move across borders and with great speed and great amounts in ways that the world can't handle. I think the end of the Cold War added to the disarray because you went from two centers of decision-making, highly disciplined and controlled, to a world now of hundreds of decision-makers, and capacity now is in more hands than ever before. I think the United States has contributed to the disarray at times by what we've done, the Iraq War, one could argue, more recently leaving the Trans-Pacific Partnership, or things we haven't done. 4 years ago in Syria, not acting when Syria crossed the red line, or not following up the Libya intervention with any sort of force. And I think the Trump administration has added to all this by introducing a much greater degree of uncertainty as to whether the United States is going to basically be recognizable in the world or whether it's going to embrace some significant departures. So for all these reasons, this is at least a world of disarray.
In his book, Mr. Hawes suggested that the world needs what he described as an updated operating system for today's globalized world. He calls his new system World Order 2.0.
Each era of history has its own defining challenges. Much of history is about the rise of great powers who decide that they're going to threaten all their neighbors. World War I, World War II, the Cold War. This is something very different. There's no great power who's threatening the security and stability of the world. But we do have a massive set of problems at the global level, where we have everything from terrorists to computer hackers to climate change to disease outbreaks to a breakdown of the global trading system. You have all these challenges, and there's a tremendous gap between the willingness and ability of the world on one hand to come together to deal with these challenges and the threats that they pose. And my argument is simply that we need to maintain the idea of sovereignty, a world of sovereign states, a world where you can't use force to change borders. But that's not enough. It's not enough to simply say everything that goes on inside your territory is your business alone. Because what we've learned is that in a global world, very few things stay local. If there's a disease outbreak, if there's a terrorist, if there's a hacker, if you have coal-burning electricity plants, all of those things will have consequences for others. So my argument is, if the 21st century is not going to be a disaster, it's not going to be a world of chaos or a world of anarchy, we have got to set up a set of arrangements that we, the world, the United States, working with others, in some cases not just with other states, it might be with companies, it might be with NGOs, that we work on what is it that states and governments have to do to regulate or control or get on top of things within their own territory that could have a negative consequence for others. And we will either do that and we will shape the 21st century in some good ways, or we will fail to do that, and this will be a century defined by terrorism and proliferation and climate change and worse. So that's the challenge, and what I argue for is American foreign policy needs to adjust to take that into account.
You're listening to the best of Press Conference USA 2017 on The Voice of America. I'm Carol Castiel, reminding you that our PCUSA podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. You may also follow us on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA or connect with us on Facebook. Let's get back to today's Press Conference USA, featuring highlights of the program over the past year. In June, I interviewed Charlie Dent, a Republican member of the House of Representatives from the state of Pennsylvania. Mr. Dent is a member of several congressional committees, including the powerful Appropriations Committee. Congressman Dent is also a member of the Problem Solvers Caucus, which is a group of Republican and Democratic lawmakers who work together to develop bipartisan solutions to legislative and policy issues. As a member of the House Appropriations Committee, the congressman said that the responsibility of the group is to ensure that the U.S. government is properly funded each year. So I asked Congressman Dent for his reaction to President Trump's 30% proposed funding reduction to the U.S. Department of State.
I've served with three presidents, Presidents George W. Bush, Barack Obama, and now Donald Trump. And I've said this with each president, that the president proposes and the Congress disposes, that the president will propose a budget and Congress will take a look at it. We'll take the things we like, we'll accept the things we like, and we'll discard the things that we don't like. And that will be the case this year. As it relates to the State Department, many of us have certainly been critical of the massive reduction to the State Department. In my view, and we've heard Secretary Mattis, when I guess he was General Mattis, and I heard General Petraeus and former Secretary Gates all kind of say similar things, that if we do our development and diplomatic missions effectively, that will lessen the need for them to buy bullets, more or less summarizing what they've said, but you get the point. And I've often said that we have a three-legged or a three-headed national security strategy that includes diplomacy, defense, and development, development being the smallest piece, but we need to do all three effectively, that we can't solve all of our problems internationally through hard power, that certainly soft power is absolutely essential, you know, arrow in the quiver, you know, of American national security policy. So bottom line is, you know, we will have Secretary Tillerson meet with us imminently in our state foreign ops appropriations meeting. He will come in and make the case, and I will be sure to ask him how would he propose reducing State Department funding by a third. And we'll look at his proposal and we'll say, well, how will this affect operations and the impact? So bottom line is, I'm less worried about the president's budget. I get more concerned about whatever the House budget may include. Specifically, right now, I think it's imperative that Congress enter into a bipartisan budget agreement that would establish the funding level for fiscal year 18. And we'll do that independent of the president's proposal. But we need to do this and do it fast. That way we can then write our appropriations bills at responsible levels.
In January, early in his presidency, Donald Trump signed an executive order which blocked entry into the United States for seven countries, including Iran, Iraq, Libya, Somalia, Sudan, Syria, and Yemen. Congressman Dent also shared his thoughts on these travel restrictions.
Well, the initial travel order, or it was a travel moratorium or a travel ban, call it what you will, I had criticized it at the time when it came out on a Friday evening back, I think it was in January, early February, I've forgotten the actual date. But when that first came out, I was very critical because to me it had been rushed. It was, in my view, haphazardly constructed and hastily implemented, and it had created a crisis at many airports. I had been contacted by some local Syrian-American family in my district who had six family members who were on immigrant visa holders, who were soon to be green card holders, and they happened to be Christian. And they boarded planes in the Middle East with valid visas. When they landed in Philadelphia, they had been revoked. So they were basically turned around in midair. They were revoked in midair and then ultimately sent back. Now, we've since had them return here. It was a very unfortunate situation. But my point was that the order was hastily constructed and it was very haphazard in its implementation. And I said that that order should not be enforced and that a more thoughtful policy had to be considered. Now, there's been a new order submitted. I still have questions about the need for this particular order. I know they've identified six countries for this moratorium. I helped develop that list of six countries when we were dealing with separate legislation a few years ago. But that list of six countries is really dealt with for the purpose of citizens of European countries who were at that time traveling down to Syria to sign up with ISIS. And the idea there was that not to necessarily ban travel from those countries, but if anybody from a European country with whom we have the visa waiver program, if anyone had gone down, a British citizen or a French or German citizen, Dutch, Belgian, had gone to Syria over the previous 5 years, we said that if they came back to Europe, the visa waiver program would not apply to them, that they would have to go to, those individuals would have to go to our consulate or embassy and be screened, further screening. That's all we did. It was not meant for a travel ban, but that's what those six countries were for. So there's some confusion about that. They said, well, Congress designated those six countries. And I said, well, yes, we did, but for a different purpose. And I think that's the point I wanted to make. So bottom line is, I never thought that this was an effective way to deal with the challenges that we're facing.
A few weeks later, I went back to Capitol Hill to talk with Thomas Suozzi, a Democratic member of the U.S. House of Representatives from New York. Congressman Suozzi is a member of the House of Representatives Foreign Affairs and Armed Services Committees. Like Congressman Dent, Mr. Suozzi is also a member of the Bipartisan Problem Solvers Caucus. Through his work with the Foreign Affairs Committee, Congressman Suozzi has his eyes on the many challenges facing not only the United States, but also other nations of the world.
There's a battle in the world going on today, and it's not like it was during the Cold War when it was America versus the Soviet Union. It was about ideology of capitalism and communism and democracy and totalitarianism. The battle in the world today is really between stability and instability. A lot of countries were propped up by America or propped up by the Soviets during the Cold War that aren't receiving that type of support anymore. And a lot of countries that are average and below average countries because of either corruption or because of lack of resources or incompetence are failing. And we've gone from 35 million refugees to 65 million refugees in the past 10 years. 10 years ago, there were 35 million refugees in the world. Today, there are 65 million refugees. And there are people that are destabilizing different parts of the world consciously. I'm concerned that Russia is doing that. I'm concerned that Iran is doing that. I'm concerned that North Korea is doing that. ISIS and terrorist organizations are doing that. They want to see instability, and they want to see different states fall apart, and they want to move into the void of that anarchy and try and gain power. Not, I think, for ideological reasons, quite frankly. I think a lot of it's just about making money, and
exactly.
I think a lot of it's about power.
Throughout his political career, Congressman Suozzi said that he has had opportunities to not only meet with people from many nations of the world, but also experienced their culture and traditions. He shared some of his personal insights in what he thinks could help make a better world.
I think that we have to understand, the world needs to understand, and the great thing about politics is that you get a window into the lives of different people. And we all share so much more in common than divides us. And we really need to learn more about each other's cultures and our religions and our backgrounds so that we can find out that we're all concerned about the same things. Who loves me? Who doesn't love me? What's right? What's wrong? How am I going to take care of my children? How am I going to pay my bills? Everybody cares about the same things. And the things that divide us are very, very small. I'm an Italian-American. My father was born in Italy. I'm a first-generation American. And, you know, when I go to an Italian-American event, whether I know the people or not, they're like, hey, Tom, how are you? And they pat me on the back because I'm one of them. And they know we went through the same common experiences. We, you know, we ate the same food. We had the raviolis with the tomato sauce. And we had the red wine. And, you know, there's a picture of a saint from the Catholic Church on the wall somewhere. And there's all these different things where Grandma would make the pasta on Sunday. But we all share these common experiences. But as my political career went on and I spent time with different people, from every different background, whether they were from Africa or they were from India or they were from Jerusalem or where they were from any country, whether they were Muslim or they were Christian or they were Hindu or they were Buddhist or they were Jewish, whatever it may be, everybody's the same as far as these different traditions that they share in common. They're different traditions, but each group has their own tradition. So we would have these ethnic concerts when I was county executive, and every concert would be the same. There'd be people up on the stage. They'd be wearing a particular costume. They'd be performing some sort of music from their native land. Out in the audience would be the parents would be beaming when their children would be performing on stage. And the elderly people would be treated with respect. And people would make sure that they were seated comfortably. And everybody would want to take pictures together. Everybody has these same feelings for each other. They're just different.
On September 19th, President Trump delivered his first address to the United Nations General Assembly. In his much-anticipated speech, the president warned that the world faces great peril from rogue regimes with powerful weapons and terrorists with expanding reach across the globe. As world leaders gathered for their annual meetings at the United Nations, I also traveled to New York City and met with Max Boot, the Jean J. Kirkpatrick Senior Fellow in National Security Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. Mr. Boot shared his reaction to the president's address to the United Nations.
Well, I thought it was really a tale of two speeches. The first part was kind of this nationalist populist speech in which he held up sovereignty as the greatest good in the world, which is really at odds with the mission of the UN, which, of course, is to bring nations together. And it's at odds to a large extent, I would say, with post-1945 U.S. foreign policy, which has been focused on leading the world. And that has not meant defending sovereignty at all costs. Normally, the defense sovereignty at all costs argument is the one that's heard from dictatorial regimes in places like China and Russia, because they're afraid of being judged by human rights standards or having other nations intrude on their abuses of their citizens. So President Trump was really echoing this authoritarian talking point, which is very unusual to hear that coming from an American president. Having said that, the second part of the speech was a little bit more true to form for an American president, because after having at first said that he would have a non-judgmental, non-interventionist foreign policy, President Trump then went on to issue very harsh criticisms of nations including North Korea, Venezuela, Cuba, Iran. And he did so to a significant degree based on their human rights records. You know, how you add that up, how you square that out, I think is very hard to say. There was definitely a tension between the first part of the speech and the second.
In his UN speech, President Trump called out North Korea and its leader, Kim Jong-un. He said, "No one has shown more contempt for other nations and for the well-being of their own people than what he called the depraved regime in North Korea." The president went on to say that if the United States is forced to defend itself or its allies, it will have no choice but to totally destroy the rogue nation. I asked Max Boot if he thought that the president accurately characterized the threat North Korea poses, not only to the United States, but to other countries of the world.
Well, I was just in Afghanistan briefly in August, and my observation is that there is basically a stalemate there, but one that has been eroding against the government and in favor of the Taliban, where they have been increasing their control of various district capitals. They are, you know, more powerful in the hinterland than they have been at any time since 2001. And for that reason, I think it's appropriate for President Trump to send a small number of U.S. reinforcements to work with the Afghan security forces, who are taking very heavy casualties in resisting this Taliban onslaught. Now, sadly, I don't see any way out of this conflict anytime in the conceivable future. I don't think that the Taliban have much incentive to negotiate because they feel like they are making gains on the ground. At the same time, I don't think that Kabul or other major population centers are in any danger of falling as long as the U.S. maintains about 15,000 troops and our allies have an effort there as well. I think we can prevent the Taliban from taking over the major population centers, even if we can't eradicate the Taliban movement, which of course has cross-border support from Pakistan. It's not a very satisfactory state of affairs. Nobody's happy about the fact that we are mired in this conflict that we can't win and that we seemingly cannot exit. But I would argue that this is probably the least bad alternative, because if we simply up and left, I think there's every reason to think that the Taliban would take over much of the country. You would once again have a civil war in the north as you had prior to 9/11, and you would have groups like Al-Qaeda and other international terrorist groups coming back en masse into Afghanistan and possibly even destabilizing Pakistan across the border. You know, the way I view it is our 15,000 troops are basically an insurance policy against this kind of catastrophe occurring. And at the end of the day, I think we basically have to try to wait the Taliban out.
Earlier this month, President Trump announced that the United States will recognize Jerusalem as the capital of the State of Israel and its intentions to relocate the U.S. Embassy to Israel from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. Our Press Conference USA program following the president's announcement featured Ambassador James Jeffrey, former U.S. ambassador to Iraq and Turkey, now senior fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. Ambassador Jeffrey shared his thoughts on President Trump's decision.
Technically, it's a symbolic application of a symbolic position. The United States Congress has recognized Israel's capital to be Jerusalem since 1995 and been at least officially pushing the administration to do so as well and to establish the embassy there. There is no indication that President Trump has any plans in the near future to move the embassy there. But by making this symbolic gesture, he is, as you said, pleasing the Netanyahu government. The problem is this gives people in the region, in the Islamic world, another reason to question where this president is taking relations with the Islamic world, because this is seen as something that undercuts the peace process between Israel and the Palestinians, and to some degree calls into question, although I don't think that's the intent of the president, the Islamic nature of some of the shrines and some of the city itself, which of course is a shared tradition of the three monotheic religions, Christianity, Judaism, and Islam.
I asked Ambassador Jeffrey how President Trump's recognition of Jerusalem as the capital of Israel will affect efforts to bring peace to the Middle East.
It's more than and a little bit different than this. First of all, the peace process, despite the efforts by Jared Kushner and the president's ambassador in Israel, really have not gone anyplace since the late Obama administration. And this idea that the Palestinians declared the United States no longer an unbiased broker, I'm sorry, if you want to talk with somebody who can get the Israelis to do anything, that address is Washington, not Brussels, not Tehran, not any place else. The biggest problem with this, first, is there's always a risk that this will ignite violence between the Palestinians and the Israeli Authority. We have seen that repeatedly with Israel in 2000, with Ari Sharon's visit there. But we've seen this repeatedly with metal detectors just a year or so ago in Jerusalem, led to another outburst of violence. So I'm very concerned about that. But the underlying problem is, at a time when Iran is scoring victory and victory across the Middle East, this undercuts the anti-Iranian alliance that the president is trying to put together with Israel, with Turkey, with the Arab states, with the United States, and with even some Shia in places like Iraq. That's the problem we have right now.
And that's Press Conference USA's look back at 2017. Thanks to Rick Pantaleo for producing this year-end edition of the program. I'm Carol Castiel. From all of us at the Current Affairs Programming Desk at VOA, here's wishing you all a very healthy and happy new year. Thanks for listening today, and please join me again next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.